I will never send you a nude. Decompress and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies nobody else wants to talk about. This is episode number 97, and my name's Jakob.
And my name's Randy.
And today, we're Nicholas again. anyway, that's just the two of us. Just the two of us talking about some horrors from the deep, let's just say. But okay, so today we're launching a little bit of a triple bill of three episodes going forward, where we'll be talking about three films about underwater creatures, underwater thrillers. I think that's the better way to call these things. Anyway, last week we talked about toy soldiers, and then, you know, like now's the time to kind of just again go back into some kind of a theme, and the theme for now is the horrors of the deep. Call them, I don't know if it's a good name, but it's a name. I'm sticking with it.
Just what put it my is. Foot down.
It's what
fits
it is.
Well.
It's...
Yeah, fits well enough.
So, might as well just do a quick Patreon plug as well for what's coming in December. So, what we had plans on doing would be to tie into our sort of episodes that are kind of will be showing up on your feed right around Christmas and New Year's time, where we're going. We had this idea of doing two episodes about 80s sequels. The idea was to do Gremlins 2 and Ghostbusters 2 and talk about them on our main show. And as a result, like, you can imagine, like, this is so basic. We'll just do bonus tie-ins about Gremlins and Ghostbusters. So, like, on our Patreon, patreon.com/uncutgemspod, you'll be able to listen to us talk about Gremlins and Ghostbusters, and then possibly maybe there's going to be a little bit of an extra recording as well going in there, but this is all contingent on how much free time we have in the month of December, because like, Decembers are busy, just like anyone with a family will know. Decembers are just a busy time. Also in the month of December, we've decided to make all our Twin Peaks episodes, so Twin Peaks Season 1, Season 2, Fire Walk With Me, and The Return, once it drops, will be available to listen to for free on our Patreon. Again, patreon.com/uncutgemspod, $3 a month, otherwise gives you access to everything we have, but now David Lynch Marathon section on Twin Peaks is available to listen to for free until the end of 2022.
What a series of conversations those were, too.
Jesus, yes. it's a story in its own right. But anyway, one day when I'm writing my memoirs, I'll be reminiscing about that time when I had to splice in that episode out of like 77 different segments. Just when I took a day off to watch season two. And then just halfway through, it's just like, why am I watching these Civil War reenactments? Oh goodness. Anyway, but we're not here to talk about Twin Peaks today. We're here to talk about underwater thrills. So let us talk about Deep Star 6.
Say again, please.
So can you fix this?
I have no idea. His transmission's broken. Stand by.
Tell me to get back to the airlock right away.
Richardson, get back to the airlock immediately. You copy.
Shut off the outside lights. What about the lights in the dive suit? Can we shut those off too?
No, not from up here.
God.
Wait a minute, there's something in the airlock.
God damn it, there's something in the fucking airlock!
So Deep Star 6 was directed by Sean S. Cunningham, who you may have know him from Friday the 13th as a director of Friday the 13th, or as a producer of a bunch of other films like House 2, and I think he also produced Wes Craven's Last House on the Left. And the film stars, and I think I'm going to name them all, because you know what? Production value. Torian Black, Nancy Everhard, Cindy Pickett, Miguel Ferrer, Greg Evigan, Matt McCoy, Nia Peoples, Marius Weyers, Elliot Baskin, Thom Bray, and Ron Carroll. That's all. That's the entire cast. That's the entire cast of this film. So the film stars these people. And it's a story about a crew of a deep sea sort of facility. I think it's owned by a US Navy. It's a US Navy project. And then these people build an underwater nuclear missile storage facility and then do some deep sea exploration in their free time. And then while they're performing some kind of a routine excavation, they punch through into a sealed off cavern beneath the seafloor, which, as it turns out, harbored an ancient creature, which is now set loose to wreak havoc upon them. And that's pretty much the film. The movie was released in 1989. I think the sort of the only sort of interesting tidbit I could find online about how the film kind of came together was like the Sean S. Cunningham had an idea about this sort of this film. I think he was intending on producing it in 1987, and that ended up being the first in the short run of sort of underwater thrillers released between 1989 and 90, which also included The Abyss, which you know, it's now a famous sort of story among Blu-ray collectors who just can't possibly wait for any longer for this to be released on anything other than VHS and DVD. Okay, also The Rift, Lords of the Deep, which was a Corman film, The Evil Below, and Leviathan, which Leviathan we'll talk about in 2 weeks' time, so stay tuned for that. Anyway, so apparently James Cameron was asked Lewis Abernethy, who wrote the story for this, and I mean the script was written by someone else whose name now escapes me, let me just quickly check, Jeff Miller, that's the one. So Lewis Abernethy was apparently approached by James Cameron, who asked him to delay the movie because he was working on The Abyss and he wanted to get there first. Was a dick move, and you know, James Cameron had a bit more of a clout about him, right, after Aliens and everything else. Anyway, so the film was supposed to be directed by Robert Harmon, but he stepped down, and then Sean S. Cunningham stepped in and just made the film. And I think they've hired also Harry Manfredini. I think that's worth mentioning. Harry Manfredini was hired to do the score to the film. And it just became this sort of little thriller that didn't really do much money at the box office, and then also became famous or infamous for the fact that everyone hated it. I think critics did not like it. The implausible plot, the characters were stupid, and film was called predictable, lack of suspense. Oh, it was just, ugh. People did not like this movie at all, which brings us to now. So tell me, Randy, do you like Deep Star 6?
Well, this was a first time watch. I have no history at all with this film. Knew very little about it actually going in, but I did a little bit of research on my own and saw, yeah, this only has like an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes or something, and a really low score, like 3.9 average or something. And it's less than 3 on Letterboxd too, less than 3 stars, 2.5 or something. So at least that's mediocre. Small samples maybe on both platforms, but at the same time, like, no one talks about this movie. It is flawed, yes. Some of the flaws are, you know, relatively big, but honestly, I thought it was pretty good, you know. And you know, finding out that this had like a small budget, this has a really nice production value for $8 million. Like, this is this is really sort of impressive fare. Like, I was sort of here for it. You know, like, when you consider like the sets and the technical design, there's the model work here. Not that that would necessarily be expensive, but I think it's pretty good too. There are a few sequences that are, you know, relatively snappy. I think it's clear here that Cunningham not only maybe competing with Cameron with the, you know, the release date, trying to finish first on the underwater thriller.
He's ripping him off coming too. Out.
What's that?
He's ripping him off too.
Yeah, like I think he's very clearly inspired by Alien, Aliens, Jaws, and even in terms of the characters that we have in here, I think that it owes a lot to The Thing. But also, like, I think the way the characters interplay, I think that it's inspired a little bit like the A-Team from TV, just function of the era, I think. Oh, but yeah. Is Cunningham putting his own stamp on this? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe, but maybe more so as a producer, just in terms of, you know, pushing his stuff out and, you know, trying to get stuff done. But at the same time, it's not bad, you know. And even too, like, you could make an argument that there's a bit of a conversation in here about nuclear nonproliferation. And just because it's the end of the 80s, it may have just naturally drifted into the script, I suppose. But, you know, there was the Star Wars missile defense system that was, you know, big in the news in the 80s. And this might be, like a bit of a, might be a bit of a response to that. Yes. So, you know, there's some things that are worth talking about here. Workplace safety, stress management. You know, how working in bad conditions can, you know, lead to making mistakes, and how the stakes are higher if you're dealing with weaponry. And I don't know, there's some interesting discussions here in a bit. It may just be happenstance, but it's not completely devoid of something to say. You know, so yeah, I'll leave it at that. Like, I think that, yeah, it's sometimes it's not a bad thing to just understand a formula, follow it, and just go about your business. Like, pacing here is pretty crisp. There's some good set pieces. I had a decent time with it. You know, I don't know how far I can defend it, but, you know, this washed over me, and I watched it twice. Like, I watched it a week or so ago, and then I watched it yesterday or the day before. Mm-hmm. It suited me just fine both times. Thought it was all right.
See, there you go. I love your deep cuts, by the way, like when you're just gonna say, yeah, this movie has something to say about like workplace safety. I'm just like, actually, yeah, it does. Like, you can see that Miguel Ferrer could have on at least 2-3 occasions could have used some like SOPs, just some, so, there needs to be some kind of like a standard of practice, some kind of like a manual somewhere where everything's specified, because this man's making so many mistakes. It's just like, well, do you think this was an aggression or a nature force? I don't know. It's just like, just checking. I'm just, what are you doing? Yeah, there should be some kind of a, you know, local code of practice somewhere on this ship. Anyway, but onto my take. I have never seen this before. I remember vaguely, I don't know if you've seen the cover of the film, the poster with the sort of space suit. And only after you've watched the film, you realize what the space suit is, that it's only half a space suit.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not a space suit. It's an underwater sort of deep sea exploration suit, right? So I remember the cover from like a VHS rental stores, and I never just got round to watching it for some reason. It was kind of just, I remember, like a curiosity that was just there. So I watched it curiously, and then I remember just when the film opens, you see Mario Casar and Andrew Viner as producers kind of showing up at the opening of the film, and you immediately know this is going to be great. Like, this, it's just,
I saw you posted about that. Yeah.
It's just, you know, this is going to be solid. And it is like, I honestly don't understand what these people don't get. Like, why this is stands at 8%. Why is this so mediocre? I mean, I can see why, when you're really cynical about this and you hate fun. Maybe it is. But yeah, to quote our buddy Kevin from the podcast who wouldn't die, it's like, it's not Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But it's the next best thing, you know? It's Marlowe. It's Shelley. I clued in immediately that this is just taking just fistfuls of Alien and Aliens iconography and even elements of like plot and storytelling. So they're essentially just retelling Alien underwater, if you think about it. And like, to the point that even I think Harry Manfredini was asked to kind of just like, just listen to James Horner and Jerry Goldsmith's scores and just do your take on this. But overall, I really enjoy the film. Like, it's so much fun. It's 98 minutes long. It's just brisk and well-paced. And also just... Maybe this is my personal bias, but it's just... There's something about people just trapped in these metal sort of sets where they can't leave. There's hatches everywhere. The iconography of the set design is just great. And I just enjoy spending time with these people, especially that there's always some kind of office politics kind of just involved in this, because there's, I think, 8 or 9 people in total in there, and they have their own, it's kind of like in Alien, they have they bicker, they have mm-hmm. their own little relationships, their little sort of dramas underpinning their own little existences within the scope of the story that's around the film. And now we're just thrust in the story that's just... we get to see, but we don't get to see why Miguel Ferrer is the way he is, why the big doctor just hates everyone or just whatever. You get to kind of just imagine certain things. But I overall really like it, and I'm looking forward to revisiting it, and I'm really looking forward to actually championing this film as something that people should really check out. Because when was it last I saw a film like this? I was watching this, and I remember just like an hour ago, there was this film with Kristen Stewart called, I think, Underwater. I think Underwater? Can't remember now. Let me check.
Yeah, Underwater.
Underwater, yes. It was directed by William Eubank. And it's essentially, I want to say it's essentially the same movie. It's just new. And I don't know, it just filters through a modern aesthetic and everything else. But I feel like whenever the conversation around this film was surfacing, it was kind of like, oh, it's kind of like Alien, and no one ever clued into just like, it's an Alien knockoff, in the same way that Deep Star 6 is an Alien knockoff, or something like Leviathan or something like this. Mm-hmm. And no one ever goes and connects these dots, because I have a feeling not enough people are aware of Deep Star 6 being a thing, even though I totally agree it's flawed and doesn't have sort of the classy appeal of something like Alien or Aliens. But overall, it's a solid piece of genre filmmaking that, you know, even within the confines of something like an Alien knockoff, it's just on a different level, like in terms of just production design, than something, anything that sort of like Roger Corman would have produced for a similar amount of money. So question is now, and let's just maybe just go from Outer Shell. Like, what's the deal here? What did the critics not get? What's happening here? Why is this film forgotten? And why and what can we do to rectify this? I like the word rectify these days, because it comes because it shares etymology with the word rectum.
So, and is one of the best television series of the last 15 years.
Rectum, yes, watch it on CBS. No,
Rectify. That's hilarious.
What's the deal with Deep Star 6, by the way? What's the malfunction here? Why isn't it sort of appreciated the way I think it should? We should.
Yeah, I think that we're both sort of, you know, lukewarm to okay or better on this. It's a fascinating question, and I can't help but think in a certain way it comes down to marketing. I think that's great that you just mentioned that. Was it Underwater, the Kristen Stewart film? Because you mentioning that made me think of another film, Stowaway, which I think was in Prime release a couple of years ago with Anna Kendrick. And to me, these types of films now that we get and they come out on streaming, they're sort of disposable, and they're usually mm-hmm. a little bit lesser, smaller a budget than something that, you know, would have a bigger campaign on streaming or would show up in theaters. So there's always been, I guess, disposable films, and maybe this film was just treated as a disposable film. Like, it's sort of, I don't understand why it was panned. I can appreciate that it was fine. I can appreciate that, you know, people didn't fall in love with it, but for it to be slammed for not being original, Jesus Christ, like it was the 80s, you know?
I know.
So Like, come on, find something else more substantive to throw on this. And to me too, like it's a surprise because it was the first. Like, there were five or six of these thrillers underwater that were coming out in 1989 and 1990, and this was first one out. This was January 1989, and the others mm-hmm. sort of came after. And this sort of came and went. And I don't know what to say except that it probably wasn't treated with the proper marketing. And then once you have The Abyss come out, and even Leviathan, I think, had more of a life, it was easier for this to get lost in the shuffle after the fact. But it was first out, it was decent, and it should have made more of an impact. Like, if you think of Volcano and Dante's Peak, we tend to sort of remember both of those. Dante's mm-hmm. Peak, I think, was the winner, if you were to ask anyone, if you were to look at it as a competition. But people remember Dante's Volcano. Peak. Yeah, I think so. Out of Volcano and Dante's Peak, or is that in fact debatable?
No, I think I'd agree. Volcano kind of meh.
Just in terms of shelf life, I know, and why notoriety.
Said Pierce Brosnan, and Pierce Brosnan was James Bond at the time.
Yeah, so you know, like these films that come out in tandems, there tends to be a winner, like one of the two or three in the set that sort of stands out. And The Abyss was going to be that, no question. But this one totally got lost, and it sort of baffles me. Unless, you know, it's a marketing thing that it was hobbled together. I say hobbled, it doesn't look hobbled together, but it had what I would call a small budget, $8 million. Mm-hmm. And it probably had a small marketing campaign. It was released in January, which was probably a pretty, weak time to release it. So, you know, distributors didn't necessarily hold a lot of hope for it either. That's my guess. And just without the marketing behind it, it just, Deep Impact and the other
Armageddon.
One. Armageddon.
That's like another, that, yeah.
There's room for both of them.
The memorable one, and he didn't remember the name.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
This is the better film you remembered.
Oh, calm down. But, it's that type of thing here that I just think that there was no effort to market this, and then it just got lost in behind The Abyss's shadow, mm-hmm. in the abyss of the abyss. I guess that's my only answer to that, because I it sort of mystifies me. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely agree with this sort of take. I would probably also add and sort of a layer onto this, that you kind of have to remember that this is not only is this like a bandwagon sort of situation of like, oh, Jesus, for some reason my hold on. Oh, I can hear myself now. Yeah, for some reason, it's not only a bandwagon situation, but it's a bandwagon of knockoffs. Like, it's not that just like that for some reason someone decided, oh, let's just do a bunch of underwater films. It's underwater films that are just decidedly inspired by Alien and Aliens, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, like, I don't understand this sort of concept of, well, you know, like, it's like, what, it's not original. I mean, like, have you been asleep through the 80s? I think there was lady in like the LA Times or wherever. I think, oh no, New York Times, Janet Maslin.
Maslin, yeah.
Just this like predictable lack of suspense. It's just really, I mean, just predictable. Is that your take? Like, we had Star Wars in 1977, and just half of the 80s was basically just a 1980s fantasy revival of just that sort. Like Willow, the...
Totally, yeah.
Never-ending Story, Crawl, Battle Beyond the Stars. Like, it's all the same. Just westerns, yeah. Westerns in space, right?
Yeah, and slashers and sequels and,
See, this
it
is
wasn't an era. It wasn't an era for predictability.
No, exactly. And then, funny you should mention slashers. I was just about to kind of get to it. Like, when you think about it, it kind of looks like it had shared the same fate as something like Black Christmas or like Silent Night, Deadly Night, and things like this. Because these are films that were just, I think, at least Black Christmas was before Halloween, and Halloween's always kind of just referred to as the slasher that kind of started it all, right? Like the biggest sort of early slasher of, because it was 1978. Meanwhile, there have already been Hollywood films kind of just dealing with this, and then I don't know, I think like you could kind of retrace it back to like early De Palma, and then into the sort of the Dario Argento and Mario Bava films from like the turn of the decade, and then all the way to Alfred Hitchcock, because it all starts with Psycho. But in general, like you could see that this is like the sort of the Black Christmas of the underwater thriller sort of alien knockoffs, because in a way you could say, well, Halloween was a sort of a descendant of Psycho, in a way that this is a descendant of Alien. But then again, The Abyss got to be the Halloween of this sort, and then I feel like someone needs to actually start talking about this film, because these films, because like I don't know where you live, but for me, getting a high definition like Blu-ray of this film is impossible. You can't get it. Like you have to kind of just like resort to really, really shady ways. Because like even DVDs, like you have to just go secondhand from like Spanish imports, and they'll have like subtitles and just godforsaken languages.
This is on a couple streaming. This is on a streaming service in Canada. If you happen to have Super Channel, and then you can get it from iTunes. I don't know about the Blu-ray availability, but yeah, no, I hear it. Like, and it's a film too. Like just going back to the Black Christmas, that's sort of a good take. Maybe it's a matter of studios distributing it don't know what to make of this, and audiences don't know what to make of it. The marketing's not there for it. But by the time, I think in August of 89, I forget what one of these other films I think came out between, if not a couple of them.
The Rift, Evil Below. Lords of the Deep. And what's the other one?
Shoot, I have a list. The Rift, The Abyss, The Evil Below, Lords of the Deep, Leviathan. Yeah, Leviathan's in March. Lords of the Deep, which is probably video. That's the Corman one, was in April. The Evil Below was video, straight to video. Mm-hmm. That's July. And then The Abyss. So it's just one of these things that studio heads and producers and execs have, oh, this would be a great idea. But it's not until Cameron comes along and he says, no, this underwater stuff is really cool, and I have a bit of a budget that I can do some really cool stuff here. And this is where he really gets into the innovation with technology and stuff and incorporating that into it. But I think also he's championing the idea of this underwater stuff is really cool. Like they just found the Titanic 2 years ago. Like that was lost to sea a couple, you know, for 70 years or whatever it was, 75 years. And they just found that, and underwater, there's this whole world down there. It's his voice through The Abyss that makes this cool, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas maybe execs not knowing how to sell it, audiences not knowing what to think of it, they need Cameron to frame the conversation a little bit. And he's sort of big into the underwater stuff. And I think he was following the Titanic discovery pretty closely. And he's starting to talk this way. And there's, I think The Abyss was troubled enough, a shoot in a lot of ways too, that a bit of... Mm-hmm. You know, story and press and PR came along with it, but it was Cameron that breathed life into this other underwater landscape, we'll say, or seascape for storytelling. And no one was with it until he explained to us how cool it was. I guess another theory.
I mean, I would say like definitely agree that this is like Cameron has this sort of, I don't know, he has this energy about it, and he can just he's just the best salesman. Like he can just make you believe that this shit's just the coolest, right? And then he also had this sort of knack for innovation, because like if you think about The Abyss, like one of the things you remember was the sort of like the liquid breathing and the idea of just the sea being this sort of harboring place for almost entire universes of stuff that we never get to see. Which I think Deep Star 6 is a film, one of the few films from in general, essentially. I mean, Underwater, actually, the newest one also kind of does it like this. That you can it touches on this, but it doesn't really commit to it too much, or maybe it does, but it doesn't really make it overt. Whereas Cameron just makes always front and center, where the underwater is a stand-in for space. And then mm-hmm. they almost treat it like this, that these sort of underwater ships, the sort of the diving suits, it's all essentially the same iconography like you could imagine it would be in outer space. And they're essentially in a different, like, this is a science fiction movie, just because in space you don't get to have the sort of luxury that if you continue going up, you will eventually surface, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of just limited by this. But at its core, the whole gimmick kind of begins with this, the deep sea exploration sort of situation being a stand-in for an outer space exploration, and how much it can do for your imagination when you think you look to the stars and you think, oh, look up all the, think about all the civilizations that kind of just like lurk in all these stars, and you can think to yourself, and this is what Cameron sold in the abyss. You can have one just at home in the Pacific Ocean. You just don't know about it because it's so deep below sea level. You don't know. It's yeah. because we never get to explore any of this. It's dark and scary over there. And so I think this is what the film does. And actually, in this regard, it actually follows quite a few tropes from Ridley Scott's Alien, to a lesser extent, I want to say, from James Cameron's Aliens. And kind of, this is something I wanted to kind of ask you about. What do you feel about how this movie is constructed, like in this sort of the ensemble cast, and then how it's kind of put together? I don't know if you had this sort of situation that I didn't quite know who the main character was, which was kind of like refreshing to me. That I kind of felt like it's the first time I like watching Alien, because I didn't quite know when I first watched Alien, because no one told me when I was very young, and also no one told me there's going to be this sort of scene is going to scar me for life in there. So I didn't quite know who the main character is until essentially they were just the only people left.
Right. Yeah. I had sort of the same response to that, actually. Like, I don't know any of these characters really, and I don't really know any of these actors. Only, I think,
Nancy Everhart may have recognized.
I don't know her. Of course, Miguel Ferrer. So yes. He stood out. And Matt McCoy, who I typically don't know, but as a coincidence, a week or so ago, I watched Hand That Rocks the Cradle, and he's the father in that, and he's really good in that. And this Deep Star 6 is, I think, I'll say 3 years before, I think, something like that. And the only other actor in here that I know, and I don't know if you remember him because we talked about him before on Prince of Darkness, is Tom Bray. And I said to myself, oh, I love this guy, because I know him from a TV show in the 80s, and I thought he was great. Always sort of remembered him. But I said, if he's here, he's going to be one of the first ones to die. And he was. So he was the guy with the beard, and he ends up in the remote unit that gets lost. He's the really skinny guy. And he was the first guy to die in Prince of Darkness with the Alice Cooper bike.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking to myself, like, what are you talking about? Because is this the hello guy, or is this someone else?
No, just before that, he's sort of the geeky scientist that comes in, and then he leaves early for that, whatever, whatever he was leaving early, but comes across Alice Cooper in the alley. Anyway, so I don't really know this cast at all. And yeah, so it was a little bit refreshing. It seems to be, the time seems to be equally divvied up. So I don't really get a sense of, you know, who I'm going to be following. You know, in my head, I'm thinking, well, I hope it's Miguel Ferrer, cause I love that guy. I hope it's Tom Braggs. I love that guy, but you know, it probably won't be him. You know, so it's sort of fun. It feels like the first time that someone would see Alien. I don't know where this is going. And this is, you know, a fun enough cast. They've got their little, you know, inner bickerings and office politics going on that you're trying to sort of sift through as a way to get to know them, but who am I going to latch on to? And it works. Like, you know, there's only 10 of them or something in total, so you're not distracted, and it's equal time for everyone, and it makes when the deaths happen, they're impactful. I think there's some, you know, good choices in who they off, like it, you know, like it, cause you wouldn't really predict, for example, that the captain would be one of the first ones to go, but.
And but how he goes.
And how he goes. So yeah, it's fun. One comic, cause I know sometimes in here we talk about when you get a, you know, low budget or you have budget constraints. So I was saying to myself, like, this to me is a little bit like Alien, but it's also a little bit like Aliens. Because I thought Tom Bray was a lot like Bill Paxton in Aliens, just sort of whining and bitching. And I was saying, okay, well, this is Tom Bray is the Bill Paxton you can afford. And
no, Miguel Ferrer was Bill Paxton.
Oh, I think they both sort of felt that. Yeah, that's true, though, about Ferrer. But yeah. So, well, you got two for the price of one Bill Paxton, maybe. And Torian Black is like the Lou Gossett that you can afford. Like everything just seems like I don't know these people. And that's a small, such a small group and small budget.
Torian Black, I'll look at this character in there and I'm just thinking to myself, is he the same guy who played Apon in Aliens? And I'm just, it's not. Because no, I just looked up his filmography.
Yeah, I had that
thought. Because the cigar is just like, welcome aboard. Like he's just a sergeant.
Right, yeah, I think that's right. I think most of these guys come from TV, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think one of the actresses, Nia Peoples, I looked her up because I wonder if she was related to... I wondered if she was connected to like just the Mario and Melvin family, but she's not. But in looking her up, she's connected to TV. She's been in different mm-hmm. TV shows. So I think that's sort of what they did. They plundered TV casts, and maybe that's what helped make it more affordable.
Mm-hmm. And just, I felt like one sort of, I don't know how to phrase this. So, one of the most positive things I could say about the dynamic in the cast was that it actually made me feel like I'm watching and like I could have like an alien-esque experience for the first time because I have no idea who these people are. I don't know who's gonna live. All I know, there's gonna be something that's gonna happen. Something's gonna happen and release some kind of a creature, and this creature is gonna start offing people, which means essentially it's gonna be Alien, right? I didn't quite know what the creature looked like. That we're gonna get to it in a second. but I was interested enough because I just felt maybe at home. I think that's the word. I think I felt at home when the film kind of just. I mean, it starts with these people just doing their little jobs. I think there's like a shift change in the beginning where you're 20 minutes late. So already they have this sort of dynamic, and there's, you know, like there's this Harry Dean Stanton and then Yaphet Kotto sort of like situation where these people kind of know each other a little bit more than the others, and there's this sort of like office dynamic in there. I'm just thinking to myself, who is Veronica Cartwright, so I can start hating on her right now. And then I had like three guesses, and they just kept jumping from one to another as these women were being pegged off, because I was just like, Nia Peoples, this she's gonna be Veronica Cartwright, and she becomes hysterical very quickly. I'm like, yeah, told you. And then all of a sudden she dies. Okay, great. And then Nancy Everhart becomes Veronica Cartwright, and she lives. I'm like, oh no. I'm spoiler by the way for the film. But like what I want to say is just with the film then kind of just converges when you kind of meet the whole cast around the kitchen table. And I just felt like the set design in there just makes me feel comfortable. Like it feels like this film could easily become like a comfort food watch for me, just for this scene alone. I don't know what you feel about this sort of like set design. I know it's kind of ripping off Alien and Aliens like just wholesale.
Oh, like mad. But you know what? There's something with this set design. This can just consistently and steadily impressed me that this feels like the used, lived in sci-fi world of Outland or Alien, just where the things around them, like it's like a gigantic submarine, like mm-hmm. it just feels authentic in so far as such a thing can. Like it feels, you know, gritty and lived in, and it doesn't feel like a set. It doesn't feel like a control room with monitors and buttons that don't really work, but they blink. And it, you know, it doesn't feel stagey and cheap. It feels well built, well realized, just on a level that honestly blew my mind for an $8 million production. Now I know it's $1988, but
it's,
still,
it's like quite a few million, right?
Yeah, it's an impressive. And when you say you're at home in it, like that makes sense to me, because I know I like other films like this, you know, other films that have this type of feel. Like when you're in the Millennium Falcon, it has sort of a real type of feel, like a weathered.
It feels like this ship's been through a lot, right?
Right. Yeah, and there's an authenticity to that, even though you're in a sort of superficial world, and it works. And you know, same with Alien and Aliens, and they're just films like this that really embrace the realism of their world, and this set really pulls you in. So yeah, your response makes total sense. And you know, similarly, like I feel at home in a story told in these sets.
Mm-hmm. I mean I would say like same goes for something like The Thing, where you see that this is not a set, even though they built it from scratch. Like actually, if I were to agree that this is a set, because like if you really look closely, like, it is a set. it's not like they just convinced me wholeheartedly that this is, you know, someone just rented a spaceship in here, right? That the set looks like they didn't have enough money to build their own stuff, so they went somewhere and they found this old abandoned Star Trek set, which has just gone rusty and dirty and moldy, and they just moved in there and used it, right? Although there's a funny little thing I had written down for this, was that even though all these sort of buttons look functional and they don't have these sort of, like, the technology is not overwhelming, like you can almost imagine that this is what these people would use, because these screens look old, they're very small, they're not very good, and they're sort of, you know, it actually looks alien-esque, as in like it's very functional and very utilitarian. And then all, apart from the fact that they have these consoles everywhere, that the smallest amount of water spilled on them is going to cause them to spark, and they still insist on keeping coffee on top of them. Not to mention that they're underwater as well, but you know. Yeah, and then they have these like little scenes of like, I'll try to rewire it and just psst, okay, well, let's just open it manually. It's just great.
That's also a great scene too, because and see, the cast is so unknown. What's that gentleman's name?
Well,
that
there's guy. Three in black, and then the Greg other guy was...
Yeah, but it's Greg Avignon. He plays McBride, and he says that a captain who's trying to, you know, do something with this door, this electronic panel, are you sure he should be doing that while standing in water, like all these sparks going, like it's, yeah, I thought that was sort of a funny funny touch. But yeah, the set here is great. Another element of the set, actually, the fact that they're standing in so much water, there's a couple of scenes in here where these sets flood like crazy, and those are great moments too. Like, this is a really wonderful set, because the water just gushes in. Like, there's one scene where a door opens and water explodes out because there's water on the other side, and then there's another scene where the set was obviously built in a gigantic barrel of some sort, and then they just dump water in because that thing fills like nothing. Like, and this is sort of impressive production value to me. Like, and again, like, it floors me, 8 million, and I wonder if these were reused Star Trek sets or something. Like, I don't have any information on that, but it goes a long way in creating this world. You know, because then you take this A-team cast, I'll call them, because they're sort of quirky in their own right, and you know, there's different things going on there that are a little harder to take seriously for me. But if you put them in this type of set, it ups the ante in my mind.
I mean, I would say, I would add this, that, you know, I want to live in a world where this set has been built from scratch, and they made it look like this, because that's just artistry for me. It's just great looking. What I will also say is, they give me, I don't know, maybe this film's biggest problem is the fact that it doesn't have like someone like H.R. Giger involved. Like, there doesn't seem like there's a hook to anything. It just looks fairly plain and standard. And then maybe this is just me responding to this variable, because when I see a little sort of miniature model of, almost said a spaceship, but this sort of underwater vessel where these guys are just driving it to do whatever, I don't know, move rockets around, I just feel I feel immensely at home with this iconography. It just feels like this is the type of science fiction I've grown up with, and then I just feel some kinship to it. Whereas I would say it lacks the hook, lacks the gimmick, it lacks the sort of iconography that you can just easily remember. Like, doesn't have the xenomorph about it. It doesn't have the sort of aesthetic of the ship that these people were penetrated in Alien. So it's essentially just you're confined to these sort of ship sets, and everything kind of just takes place in there, and then the creature kind of comes into play into the ship. So you, by the way, you don't see the creature for like over an hour, by the way, even though very early on the creature makes an appearance as in on the sonar screen or whatever. But you observe it only through a third person perspective through secondhand debriefs, or just, well, someone heard that this guy screams and then you never heard from them again. And then, so here's your take. Here's it. Like, how do you feel about how Sean S. Cunningham and the storytellers in general, they decided to kind of keep the creature a secret for nearly the entire film, like 2/3 of the film at least, right?
Well, I can get behind that because you get something similar in Alien, right? Like you create a threat and you don't see the threat, but the threat is there sort of as this character that's in the scene without seeing them. Like Alien is that. Like it's a long time before we actually see the alien, and the alien is concealed in shadows a lot.
But you see the facehugger, you see the chest burster, you see all the little sort of let's just say heralds of what the alien's going to become.
Yeah, right? for sure. And, you know, like Alien is a very, very, very special movie. And that's those extra touches and immersions into sort of the creature sort of elevate it. But you don't see the creature till much later on. My thing with this film, and I'll bring it up here, and I sort of wonder if it's a bit of a flaw. I wonder if it has a little bit of an identity crisis in a way. Because on the one hand, it wants to be Alien, underwater Alien. But on the other, there's this whole subplot with detonating a nuclear missile by accident and just, you know, whether or not the Navy can get this missile underwater missile silo installed on time. There's this whole other piece, which I feel that Cunningham and the script are equally invested in, and one takes away from the other, and either one of them on their own would have been great. By the time the alien comes out, you're distracted by, oh, well, there's this explosion that's also happening, and you've got this crisis that's happening within the cast, within the team, just internally, just Miguel Ferrer, you know, starting to lose his mind and succumbing to stress. And that more so has to do with the missile silo stuff. And, you know, who is it that really has their thumbs on the switches of these nuclear bombs? You know, that type of discussion. So it sort of wants to be two things, and it can't really be as good a film as it could be if you dial back on one and go one direction or the other. So I think it wants to be the alien underwater. And as far as that goes, by the time we were really invested in the alien, and we see it, it's this presence in front of us, but it's not a very impressive presence. I don't really like this alien. You know, I sort of wonder if Stranger Things has a little bit of a fondness for it, because it looks like the Demogorgon in Stranger Things in my mind.
It has a name, by the way.
Does it?
I found it in a monster movie wiki page.
Oh yeah,
it's called the Diplodon. It's a Eurypterid monster.
Well,
so. I don't know if it helps, but
doesn't necessarily help.
But yeah, someone thought about this.
Yeah, yeah. But to me, at that point, like if you want to go that road, then it's turning into an animal attack film, and you know that type of a thriller. But it's not quite working because you've spent all this time with the, you know, the nuclear missiles and stuff. So I feel that's where it doesn't really take hold and be as good as it could be. It's just on the whole, the way that Alien does. Alien makes that call, you know, but the halfway point, this is a craft that's under siege by this alien that is very unique in how deadly it is, you know, with its its blood is acid and all these other unique elements, which just sort of heighten the level of the threat. Here, you don't have any of that. There's just, I thought we were going to have that when we experienced it on sonar, because you have Tom Bray, Jesus Christ, you see how fast that's going? Holy shit. Like, you've got this great discussion and exposition about it. That's moving so fast. That's so big. And it, I guess it hits the ship or the vessel and knocks it off its mooring. Yeah, and then everyone sort of jostles around inside. And, you know, that's great. And here's another problem I have with the alien, actually, is there's this big deal made about how big it is and how fast it is. But then once it gets inside the ship, inside the airlock, you know, it's just twice the size of a human. It doesn't, like, it's how like is this big alligator enough?
The alligator, yeah. And the alligator film is bigger than this.
So how is this big enough to rock the whole ship off of its perch? Well,
it's because it's very fast.
Speed
times mass. Momentum.
There you go. True. But at the same time, it didn't live up to the excitement of that original blip when it showed up on the sonar.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. Like, I was honestly convinced for the entirety of the film. Like, once you see the creature just show up with a sort of blah, and then with its, you know, I don't know, with its tentacles and claws, whatever, and mandibles.
Demogorgon and, face.
Yeah, but I was convinced that this is going to be like Jaws 3 situation, that this is just a baby shark of the situation. The mama's outside. The big mama's outside. And then,
yeah, the fact that it could get inside the airlock just defied what was given to us earlier.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily mind that too much. I mean, interestingly, by the way, do you think this film actually tries to kind of just, because you mentioned this, well, there's one thing that it's trying to be the sort of creature features of Alien underwater, which is a fair gimmick to try and accomplish. And then this sort of nuclear non-proliferation situation and having this commentary. Do you think it's in the way?
Yes.
And so do you think a similar, because I'm just thinking, like, is there a commentary in Alien? Of course there is. It's this sort of the corporate, the evil corporation just puppeteering lives of people, right? Do you think it's in the way in Alien, or is it kind of accomplished a little bit more gracefully?
No, I think in Alien it works fine, right? Like, that's flavor, and we can take themes and messaging out of the world that we're in. Here, I think the nuclear missiles and lining those up, that's a whole other subplot. So for a long time, like, where is this going? What's the climax going to be about? Is it going to be about these missiles going off? Is it going to be about them, you know, the Navy cutting off this project, which seems to be largely done by private contractors? You know, like, where are we going here? That's never in any doubt in Alien. Like, I think any you know, office politics and, you know, bitching about the job, that's character developing, that's world building, but it's not in the way of anything. Mm-hmm. Here, I think it is in the way. You know, that's my take, is that it's just, well, are we going after that, or are we going after the business of the alien? And yeah, it's like, to me, it's in the way.
I mean, I don't think, I mean, I never thought it was in the way for me. I mean, I felt kind of like, okay, well, this is just the setting. This is just a point of interest, because in Alien, I can completely disregard the sort of the corporate sort of aspect of the villainy of Ash or whatever. I can take it aside, put it aside, and the film still cooks on all cylinders, because it's just a rudimentary speaking, just a perfect horror film. And here you could say, Well, they're already setting themselves a ceiling anyway, because they're trying to accomplish Alien underwater. So they're never going to surpass it, or it's highly unlikely that they would. But I don't think the sort of the nuclear missiles, for me, this is just for most of it is it's just color. It's just setting, right? And then, because it doesn't really factor into anything as plot points, apart from, I think, just being a point of interest again to recreate a similar situation to what happens in Alien, where Ellen Ripley is trying to self-destruct the ship, and she opens a similar sort of case, and there's just these buttons that Miguel Ferrer presses, and kind of looks like it's a bit of an homage to this, even though it's kind of just taken comedically, because like the computer asks him questions, just do you want no because he's asked to dispose of rockets, or is that what he says? Like, yeah, we need to dispose of it. Okay, well, so a computer asks him questions like, how do you want, what do you mean dispose? Put them away for storage, destroy, or destroy, and then destroy. Okay, well, how do you want, why? It's just these follow-up questions, like Windows asking me questions.
It's like a Windows wizard asking you questions too.
As a result of aggression, or as a result of a force of nature? Is this wind blowing things over? What's going on? And he just makes a phone call to his... to these two women, like the doctor and then Nancy Everhart's character. I don't know what her job is on the ship, by the way, but then they just say, just do it, and he just detonates this. And then I suppose the commentary, if you really want to dig for it, would be just, well, you detonated a 20 megaton missile underwater, which would be the equivalent of Castle Bravo, so enough to awaken Godzilla, right? And nothing really happens. Because it's underwater, so I think, is this how we should just treat our nuclear missiles? Just stick them all underwater. If they all blow up, nothing's going to happen because all the radiation is going to dissipate anyway. So we're just...
Or if we fart around with nuclear weapons too long, they're going to be in the hands of, you know, people who make administrative errors. Like, that's sort of what I wanted how you the took commentary it? Okay. was. Yeah. But still, at the same time, but I do take this as a whole other thing. Like the detonation of these nukes is a whole other thing from the alien. And yeah, to me, maybe dialed back the business with the nukes and the missiles, and just concentrate on dealing with the alien, which is what, in fairness, Alien and Aliens does.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe the sort of the big mistake this movie makes, and it's not that it really bothers me too much because I can have fun with it any day of the week anyway, is that they kind of hold the creature back for an hour.
Yeah, with...
Just completely, just show me even a glimpse. I think it would have been an interesting sort of wrinkle. Just show me a tentacle, show me a claw, I don't know, something.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. There's something missing here, that the alien business doesn't really work well, really ever. Like, there's some, I guess, a few good scenes around it, but it never really cooks the way that it does in Alien. Like, that's for certain. And, you know, maybe if it's treated differently, if the exposition is set up a little bit differently, if there's something to substantiate the excitement of the original blip. Jesus, did you see how fast that was going? If there's something else to substantiate that. And that, in a way, like, just thinking back to Alien does that, because you have the mystery around the face hugger, and you can sort of look at that and it's dead and what on earth. And, you know, then there's the chest thing, which is this great moment. So there's nothing else to tide me over until the alien really does wreak havoc. Like in this film, there's nothing along the way to tide me over. So it's just time spent with these people. And, you know, there's a couple rescues because of the blip. But yeah, if you're going to tease the alien, like, that might've helped it. I don't know. Like, but yeah, the alien business is relatively weak, and like, it's a fairly weak alien in a way, in my mind. Like, it's not,
it's a 1950s sort of alien, if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. With, you know, in the 1980s, it's a little bit cleaner than something you'd get from, you know, Them or a Harryhausen film or something. But
yeah,
but still, you know, it's sort of lacking in a way.
I mean, see, when you say, well, there's not much about the alien, but when you think it to yourself, I think maybe this is a little bit unfair to kind of just compare it to Alien. Say, like, look, it doesn't stand to Alien. Well, nothing stands to Alien. Like, maybe I'm just too in love with Ridley Scott's film, because to me, it's like the second best film ever made, possibly, right? But
even still, it's a gold standard. I think that's fair.
So if, when you say, well, one of the major gimmicks of Alien was the biology of the alien that you kind of didn't, we had not seen before, that there's this egg and there's this one thing that comes out of it and does this and then just lays an egg and the egg grows into this and just take comes out and this thing sheds its skin multiple times and then really shit the bed, because what they should have done was just let the cat loose and then would have hunted it down like a mouse and just like brought it and just meow. Here's a gift for you. Anyway, roll credits, right? But it doesn't have this sort of thing. It's just a creature that you meet. And then I think the problem is that you meet it like an hour in. So I think if you, maybe it would have been a bit more so focused experience, because maybe that's what it is. I mean, it doesn't bother me, but I could see maybe how you can kind of get easily distracted by, am I supposed to care about these rockets? Because there's a creature in here that they're not showing me. Is this what it is? But I don't know. I don't know if you felt that way, but once the creature makes an appearance, the film kind of just goes into overdrive. It kind of goes batshit crazy for me. Like, it doesn't really stop for half a second. Maybe even to its own detriment, because some decisions that are made in there are kind of stupid. But in general, I just feel like it kind of just jumps from set piece to mini set piece, because these people change these rooms and there's always, on top of the creature being a threat somewhere, like that crocodile somewhere lurking underneath the surface of the water, there's also the fact that they're underwater, they have to decompress, they have to use these hatches and they can't open them on time, they have to do certain things, they have to wait a while, and that creates suspense. Which kind of just leads me to believe that the main gimmick of the film, because if they try to use the gimmick of biology or whatever, you could easily see like you're just trying to be alien, but you're failing, right? The main gimmick of what they're trying to, I think, capitalize on is the gimmick of this being underwater. Like, they're trying to actually make use of it. And I think they're succeeding for the most part in making use of the medium of it, that it's not outer space, that this is a medium that can, A, you can use, and B, it's actually a threat, both while it's also an advantage that you can actually go and leave it eventually, right?
Yeah, going back to the scene where this first shows up as a sonar blip, I really think that's well done, and I really like Tom Bray in that moment, because he's flipping out and like his eyes go all wide and did you see that thing, and he starts cussing and I can't believe that, oh my god. And then there's, I think, so that's the sea cat, I think they call it, the small little rover that they're in. And then there's the sea track, I think they call it, which is sort of the bigger unit. Then the creature, again, another blip on the radar, sonar, they see it and it whacks the machine and knocks it. And it's a bigger unit, right? And it's sitting on the edge of a cliff and it knocks that closer to the edge of tipping off. So what is happening here is Cunningham is creating suspense and he's doing a great job and we're not seeing it, but this is a formidable presence outside of the vessel. And then from there, though, I don't think he knows what to do with it. How do I capitalize? I think he totally sets us up nicely without getting into biology, without too much mimicry of alien and focusing on that. There's this big ass fast creature that we don't know anything about, except maybe it's following lights. That's the only suspicion anyone has. That's going on, and that could work well enough, but then all of a sudden it's in the airlock and turns out no, it's not the size of another ship, it's actually the size of someone standing on someone's shoulders. It's only,
so it's
10
the payoff
tall.
Payoff, so, doesn't match, there's a mismatch.
Yeah, like I think we could have had something that was set up in some earlier exposition, and just as a blip, and I think that was effectively done. But the payoff, and maybe this is sort of coming around the time where you're saying, well, the film, it's getting more kinetic, there's more going on, and it's busier, and suspense is being created. But it's just set piece and busy. This is part of that. Part of that busyness is, the reveal of this alien and it gets in the airlock. And to me, a lot of that is a bit of a disappointment in terms of the creature, because I do think it was set up well and that could have continued. Maybe not inside the ship. Maybe there needed to be something where it was attacking it from outside, or I don't know. There was something that was a bit of a letdown once the ship got inside, once it could fit in.
I'm telling you, this film just lacks the sort of the extra $5 million in budget for when Nancy Everhard and what's his face? Is it Greg Evigan?
Yeah, the, like
McBride.
Yep.
Which, by the way, the fact these people have like intimate relationships with each other and they still refer to one another with their last names. What a ridiculous concept. Like, that is just, no. Like, there's just this woman goes like, oh, I ran out of water. This is going to make an appearance. I ran out of water on my showers. Like, how long have you been underwater, first of all? And then she just, like, this guy waltzes in on her naked and just lends her the shower. And then she just, I suppose, just gets in the shower with him. I suppose it's her boyfriend. But they refer to each other by their last names. I'm like,
yeah, why? That is an appearance coming up with me, too.
It's just, no, but what I was trying to get at before I derailed myself, because that's just my superpower, was that this film lacks the sort of $5 million to just build the third act out of them escaping the station eventually and then coming in contact with the big mummy. The big... Mm-hmm. So, sure. So the big twist would be like, no, the thing that was knocking on our doors and then just knocking over these vessels, that wasn't the little thing that we had to deal with inside the ship. That was just a baby that this thing just let itself in. No, the big monster is still outside, and then we have to deal with it then. And I feel like this would be interesting, but then it kind of stops being an alien gimmick. It's kind of becomes something else.
And I feel think like you're onto this, something.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 totally. Yeah. Because I take it from your statement and your idea there that you sort of agree that once we see the creature, it's not that special a thing either in look or, and is a bit of a letdown in terms of size and speed.
I think it's a letdown in terms of there's a mismatch. I mean, I agree with, I think there is a mismatch between what Cunningham sort of sets up with how the film's edited and put together. Like, you actually expect something, let's just, I don't want to say, you know, I expected something different. Like, you know, it's just like you see this outline and you just like things like, look at this, how big is this they're gonna be? And then just like, no, it's a banana, it's just an average looking penis. You lied to me. It's just, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It just feels like this sort of like a Lamborghini with a three-cylinder engine under the bonnet. It's just, yes. Like, looks nice. It's just, no. It's still a Fiesta underneath.
Yeah.
It's just, it's someone's garage project. Like, that's what it is. But I feel like, yes, I agree that there is this mismatch. There is this disappointment of like, is this what I've been waiting for? But at the same time, because I love the thing so much, that I feel it's cute. Like, I like the design. I just like, look at the mandibles. They're looking, they're like, you can almost feel like they're mechanically, these struts are working. You can almost hear them going, whoop, whoop, whoop. Just, it's great. Yeah. But
it looks like the plant from Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, only it doesn't have Rick Moranis, which, you know, one thing that, you know, like, if this film does not need Rick Moranis.
Oh, could have used it instead of Matt McCoy.
But yeah, I agree that there's something underwhelming about the creature. But then again, I forget about this because I feel like there's still people trapped in it, in this room with this creature. And then eventually, I just treat it. Maybe this is me just looking at it through the sort of like the rose tinted glasses of this is just a science fiction of the kind that I just grew up with.
Well, I think I'm with you. Like, this is a matter of we're sort of nitpicking here and we're trying to figure out, okay, what is the shortcoming here? Like, I'm sort of okay with this too. Like, this works. And as part of it, like, you still have a set piece here and the set piece is pretty good. And, you know, you still got the, it all works particularly well because, you know, it's a decent cast and they're selling everything and the set is great. The, you know, the look of the thing is, not the creature, but the, you know, the look of the scene, like the moments, mm-hmm. it works for me. I just think we're sort of deconstructing here and maybe even trying to find what, you know, the critics that hated it, like if they were nitpicking it at this type of level, maybe I could see it, but they're not. And I think that we're both on a similar page saying, well, we're sort of nitpicking here, but it doesn't mean it's not enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Like this is still satisfying. Because that's my take too. Like this still sort of works. I mean, just oh, yeah. what would make it better?
I mean, oh yeah. I mean, I don't think people have actually given it the time of day, mm-hmm. sort of, or the attention, or just they spent long enough thinking about this. Because I suppose if you're a professional critic working for the New York Times or Chicago Sun Times, on that week you would have watched like 17 other films that you have to write reviews for, and it would be just like, oh, this is just this genre film. And I feel this is kind of like the bane of this film's existence. It's just, at the end of the day, it's just a genre film. Like, it doesn't have anything else about it. Like, there's no meat on the bone. And I suppose you could see it like that. And it's just a thriller. And it's fine. It's just 10 people being pegged off one by one. And I don't necessarily think you need to have like this sort of thematic of, like, look about what it says about nuclear non-proliferation. It doesn't really need that. I think a genre film is still... a genre film. If a genre film is just a genre film at the end of the day, it's still fine. If it does what it needs to do, as in like it provides visceral entertainment of some description, I'm fine with that. I don't really necessarily expect this to be the Green Mile that I have to just start, you know, like thinking about my life a little bit.
Yeah, it's like all July we talked about animal attacks films, fairly basic structure, and if you just sort of follow the line, color within the lines, you know, you don't have to come up with something fancy, but you can come up with something that works. And I think that's the territory we're in here. And a lot of people, you know, didn't appreciate that there wasn't necessarily an overly creative angle to it. Mm-hmm. And so, I think a lot of films probably get slammed because, yeah, there's not really a creative angle, or the filmmaker's not really pushing this into totally new territory. Like we talked about it a bit when we talked about River Wild, like trying to imagine what the, you know, why were the critics sort of lukewarm on this? And, you know, because it's just a genre film. I can see that take here. I can see that take on any one of a number of films, but I don't think it's necessarily always fair for a film to be totally shat upon for just being plain, for lack of a better word.
But see, you know, here, something like The River Wild, like if you think about it for long enough, you'll see that there's a marriage therapy in this film, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then on the sort of like this the subconscious sort of thematic subterranean level, like it has a lot baked into it. What I actually feel like maybe this is it. Like I'm not trying to second guess the critics of the time seeing this January release and then saying like, oh, it doesn't really say anything about the world at large. Look at all the other films that, you know, that do. Maybe it's that it doesn't have the sort of the leading character. It doesn't have a Ripley. It doesn't have John McClane. It doesn't have someone whom you would recognize. Like you put Arnold Schwarzenegger in this film, and I think people would be just like, look at Arnie doing all this shit all by himself, right?
True. But when Alien came out, Sigourney Weaver was not a household name at that time.
No. Yeah. That's true. But then again,
it's weird.
But then again, Alien had these other things as well to kind of just like, well, once you actually start seeing these things, well, eight was the 70s. So it was just before the sort of era of the sort of muscular leading man, right? But then had these other things like this, these hooks of this biology, this aesthetic iconography that's just kind of unheard of. And the sort of the lived-in sort of the truckers in space universe of these decrepit ships that doesn't happen before 1979 very often, right? Like this is not real. Star Wars did it, but then that was it, right? Where, you know, it's so I feel this film could have probably used a more recognizable face. And on some level, I was kind of thinking, is Miguel Ferrer going to be the one that survives? Please tell me it's Miguel Ferrer who's going to be the one that survives. Because I think like this guy needs a break, because he's always either playing these just unlikable assholes who just bite the dust way too early, or Or he's playing these villains who just like hope they would bite the dust way earlier than they do.
He's halfway in between. I like Miguel Ferreira and his character, the way he's written here. He is a guy sort of stuck in the middle. You know, no one really likes him, but he's always and only ever trying to do his job. Like, he's sort of a sympathetic character in a way, because like he's constantly being dumped on, and you know, no one's respecting him because this shift was supposed to come 20 minutes ago. You guys are 20 minutes late. So he's just sort of this frustrated soul. Like he's asking the doctor to write up some sort of a reason to get him to the surface sooner, because he's already been, he's had his stay extended from 4 months to 6 months, and he's getting tired of it. And, you know, like I think he's a well-written character, and I think he's as far as the cast goes, and in terms of the characters, I think he might be the best written character, and I think he's the most compelling performance by quite a bit too. And he does some things in error which make him the bad guy, but he's not really a bad guy. So there's a whole interesting angle to him, which I quite like. And that's something to root for, that's sort of special in here. But you could argue he gets the fate he deserves, or you could argue that he doesn't. But you know, he has a great death sequence. Actually, the last half hour of this film features a number of great Miguel Ferreira moments.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're gonna make an appearance, by the way.
Yeah, my list too, I think.
And I was as you were speaking, I had this aha moment, and I'm not sure if you're gonna keep this in. Maybe not. I don't know. What would you think about indulging ourselves in this month of December, and then maybe staging a bonus tie-in episode about The Abyss? Because now I just want to watch this again, and then just say, like, maybe there's a conversation to be had about how these films kind of fit together, especially that like at least two of the three that we're going to talk about in this little series are kind of from the era. I mean, and the era being the span of 2 years. Same year, sort of. Because Deep Star 60.
There's like six of them by before summer of 1990. It's this weird glut of these movies. I would totally entertain that.
So
I love James Cameron.
Amazon.
Try to track it down.
Just stay with us, listeners, because we're planning. Oh, I can get it on DVD. DVD. Fine, I'll do it.
It's not on Blu-ray, is it?
Don't even start.
No, I know. Didn't think.
This is a very touchy subject. Because I hate to use the word, but the fucker has the transfers ready. He's just like, I'm never getting around to sign off on this. And I feel like he's got cold feet because he remastered these films with massive digital noise reduction. And then once they released like Predator and then Terminator 2 with these DNR sort of problems where people were really hating on this, he's not going to release True Lies in the Blu-ray and the Abyss on Blu-ray because they probably look shit.
Maybe.
But I really want to talk about this movie. Like, it's just, I don't know. So stay tuned, folks, for more. The Abyss is the Abyss bonus time is coming in your ears. It's just, because I feel it's appropriate to kind of just talk about The Abyss. I don't know. It's just my take. But
as the loudest voice in the room, like the Abyss, and going back to what we were saying earlier, I think some of these films came out and it just seemed like genre stuff, not that special, rip off of Alien, rip off of maybe some underwater stuff from Aliens or whatever. Or even Jaws, you can say there's some Jaws type of stuff in here too. But it's Cameron, when he comes along with The Abyss, like he frames the conversation saying, no, this shit is cool. And then people pay attention. I feel that that's what The Abyss did. honestly. Mm-hmm. And it's probably part of the era as well, because I mentioned this before, like the Titanic, I think it was 1986 or 87, it was discovered. That was sort of a big deal. So I think there's a bit of just sort of public fascination with with underwater, the mysteries underwater. So yeah, makes sense. Stay tuned, everyone. This is going to get even deeper.
I love them puns. Yeah. Love them puns. I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like I'm spent. At least my notes are kind of depleted. I think we've touched on... No, one thing. The ending. What do you feel about the ending ending? So when they when McBride and Nancy Everhart surface, and then my go-to comparison was what happens when the creature attacks in what essentially is the only jump scare of the film. Then McBride proceeds to do what I called the Jaws 2 maneuver of dousing everything in petrol and just deliberately setting the fire. What do you think about the ending?
Well, the jump scares, to me, even like it got me, like I will admit, yeah, that was an effective jump scare, but it reminded me a lot of the jump scare at the end of Friday the 13th. Like it's just sort of the a little hand. Bit out of nowhere, something coming out of the water. So yeah, I thought it worked, but you know, there's so much about this alien I don't know, and it's not really, I'm not told enough so that I care or understand, that it's just something that's popping up out of the water. Like if this thing has been living in what they describe as a lava bubble for 200,000 years or whatever,
it's probably hungry. Then,
yeah, it's probably feeling a bit peckish. But why is it coming to the surface? Like it just seems this whole ending exists just for the purpose of the jump scare. And I don't know. I honestly can take it or leave it. It doesn't ruin it for me, but it doesn't do much for me at the same time. Sorry to anyone out there that hasn't seen it and we just ruined that there's a jump scare at the end.
But, sorry.
Yeah.
You should, like, I don't know. Like, you should have listened to the beginning of this conversation, by the way. If you're one of those people and said, like, you know, I really want to watch this film, and just watch it and then finish. But you know, it's your own funeral. I think it's just the ending kind of testifies to the fact that this movie needs another villain. Like it needs the big monster, because like, as you said, like Jimmy Cameron would have never let this happen. I think he would have just probably figured this out, like scientifically speaking. It's like this monster lives at the bottom of the ocean. It can't surface because it's gonna pop
right
out of decompression. Like Miguel Ferrer,
we'll
which is going to make an appearance.
I feel there's a bit that we've skipped over Miguel Ferrer and his workplace safety concerns and a number of things, but they do come to a bit of a head, and I have a suspicion that they'll be discussed in our list.
This conversation is going to happen. But yeah, like in general, I kind of feel like this is like I think the ending is essentially just to put a you know, like a full stop at the end of, and this is how we ripped off Alien again, right? Because it has this sort of the detonation of the ship, and then the shot is almost identical with how Nostromo blows up and this little sort of capsule gets kind of just thrown about in this sort of shockwave. And then naturally the sort of the follow up from that was that the alien was in the capsule, right?
Yeah.
And so you have this whole another act on top of that, right? When here you don't get an act, you get kind of like, this is like a postscript of just, oh, here's this monster, and then just we deal with it, and then we're just gonna go and have sex in the boat, or I don't know.
Yeah, well, it turns into slasher tropes in a way. Like, I think Cunningham's like, huh, how can we wrap this up? And yeah, I've got some ideas from various films I've produced over the last decade, and I feel like that rushed sort of choppy, simplistic, one jump type of ending that might come from his background in films the previous decade, like just with, you know, jump scares and, you know, a quick demise or a sensational death of the killer, you know, that type of a thing. Like I think that we're in slasher land in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we've covered it. So, final take on Deep Star 6?
Deep Star 6 was a deeply Starry. Hidden treasure. And, you know, this was fun. Like, I know we just spent most of the last hour and a half talking about sort of nitpicky little problems. But, you know, I can live with pretty much all of them. So a couple other problems I will raise in the moments to come. But, you know, this is a nice little thriller. It's not overly sexy. It doesn't deviate too far from predictability. And in a way, I find predictability for a genre film, especially one like this. Yes, it's a complaint. Yes, it can be a concern. But, you know, these people who, you know, wrote their whole review around this one complaint, I don't think that's entirely fair. I think there's a lot of merit in here. And I think it's sort of, you know, fun. And it's a great runtime. It's under 100 minutes. And it just is what it is. And I can't stress enough, this blows my mind. Production value for an $8 million budget, even if it's like 1988 that they shoot it and 89 that they release it, this is a really impressive production. You know, just in terms of what you get on screen, you'd never guess this was 8 million, even back then, in my opinion.
Yeah. I'll quote here from Time Out. This is on Wikipedia, by the way. So Cunningham apes Ridley Scott and James Cameron competently enough, and there are scary moments, but he has not got that vision thing, unquote. This simply rehashes the phony trappings of countless TV shows to boldly go where we have been before. And I'm just thinking to myself, so what? Like, it's not Shakespeare. It doesn't really, I know what it's trying to do. I know it is trying to ape Scott and Cameron. It is trying to capitalize on Alien and Aliens by introducing the gimmick of space and underwater being sort of equated in some way, and it's fine for me. It doesn't break new grounds. It's not gonna make an appearance on my top 100 list, and it's just impossible. But it's a competently sort of put together genre film, competently enough put together genre film that I can just have fun with it. And it's just predictable, fine, implausible, great. But it rides on this nostalgia for me. That's fair enough. But I have a good time watching it. And that's all that matters for me. It's a 98 minutes of just pure entertainment of, let's just call it from the lower shelf. But it's still entertainment nonetheless. Like, I don't feel like I've wasted my time watching this. And sure, it kind of looks like if you actually go and examine this episode now, this whole conversation, and you just think to yourself, like, we're just nitpicking this to bits. Like, we really think, like, are you guys not prepared to talk about anything positive in here? Like, we did. It's just, it's kind of fun to kind of just go and prod a little bit and see, well, how do we make this different? Just to see what material this is made of. So I had fun watching this. It can be easily improved if you just sit down and just think about it for a second. But I think it's a mistake to kind of walk into it thinking that you're going to watch The Godfather, right? Like, this is not Jaws. This is not, you know, De Palma. This is Sean S. Cunningham. Man who did, you know, Friday the 13th. I mean, I like Friday the 13th. I like it a lot. But then again, it's not Halloween. It's not, you know, Psycho.
Yeah.
It's a serviceable slasher with Kevin Bacon getting an arrow to the neck, which is great, right? Same goes here. It's a slasher with a bunch of people being pegged off one by one, and you get and the main sort of, apart from the alien gimmick, the main sort of enjoyment you get is from figuring out who's gonna live, which is what like half of slashers is basing their sort of entertainment upon. So I had fun with it. It's good.
Same, and I'd say this too about our conversation, which if someone does think it's negative, like, it, I mark a lot of essays from students, and as I go through it, I will nitpick it at the level that it's at the level that their language and their writing is at. So if you look at it after, you'll just see a lot of red marks. But what I try to do in my communication piece is to say in a paragraph at the end of the essay, this is what you did right. And I think that this film does most everything right. And then if you look through it, you're only going to see the red marks. And I think that's what we did here. And that's a fair approach, I think.
Yeah. So I think we did it. Yeah. So it's all fun and games now. Top threes and bottom threes. Randy, indulge me.
All right. Okay. Yes, I am going to just throw out a couple names that I have already. Tom Bray, I think he's really good at this, the way he rolls his eyes. Someone says, get the video. And he's like, ugh, next thing you know, she's going to want stills. And then they ask for stills. And
that's a good scene, actually.
Yeah. He's, you know, he's just a working stiff. And two, like we, like I said, oh, he's the Hicks. He's the Bill Paxton. And you're like, oh, no, it's Ferrer. Well, they both can, because I think they're both these working stiffs. They just want to do their job. They just want to go home. And I think this is him. Like, he just, I'm in my seat now. I just want to go, and I want to move this missile from point A to point B. Run the video. Ugh, I don't want to run the video, even though, like, he just reaches behind his head and flicks a switch. Like, there's no real work. I don't want to do this. Anything other than his routine, he doesn't want to do it. I think he's just great.
It's just like, how long is it going to take? 20 hours. Okay, 26 hours.
Yeah, he's the union man. I think it's great. Again, we mentioned this, an honorable mention, but just to mention it again, the production design here, the sets, the model work is great. And the sets in terms of some of the fast flooding and just some of the mechanics and utilitarian nature of this machinery and equipment, really, really good, really, really cool looking. Okay, I'll start with now my actual list. I have four. I'll say Miguel Ferrer, when he accidentally stabs the, I think he's British, Van Gelder, that's Wires. And so just to explain, anyone who hasn't seen the movie, there's this weapon and it's like a spear, and if you poke it, it will inflate. So
because it has a CO2 lady, cartridge.
This lady, she grabs it and she spears this chair, and you know, it just inflates in an instance. Anyway, there's this great moment where Ferrer accidentally stabs one of his colleagues with it, and his chest inflates, so he's got one huge breast suddenly, then it explodes and he dies, and it's just this great moment. I think that's awesome. I do also like the creature attack. So the blip, whenever the small, I think they call it the sea cat, the one with Tom Bray and the other gentleman in it, the small one, that attack, and just this alien is created as this big threat through just a blip. I think that's really great stuff. Tom Bray flipping out, he's fantastic in there. And this is, I wonder if it's, you know, a ripoff of Aliens when he's going, oh my God, 200 meters, 150 meters, 90 meters. I was wondering if it was going to go down. Oh my God, that's in the room. But we didn't get that close.
Watching The Naked Gun again.
So that was great. I also really liked, so this is my number two, the heavy door with the lever that crushes Captain Laidlaw. Just great scene all around. And then number one is when Ferrer is losing his wits about him. He's stressed to the max, and he takes the escape pod and leaves, just goes to the surface, and then his body decompresses. So he's starting bleeding from everywhere and shaking. Just great. It's gruesome. It's just fantastic. Fantastic visuals, well-realized scene, and it's an interesting end to an interesting character too. So it's all around great.
Oh, it's going to be an echo chamber here. I've got six. Okay. I couldn't decide. So I'm going to list, because I've got small ones, I've got big ones. So I'm going to mix them together, because I've just got them listed in no particular order. So I've got them. This is my note. Miguel Ferrer turning off his flashlight. So there's the scene, because I think there's a piece of blatant exposition where I think Scarpelli, Nia Peoples, I think that's her name is, She goes like, well, have you heard about photomigration? That some creatures, they feel aggression towards light and they think there is a feeding response attached to it. So obviously this foreshadows the fact that the blinking lights of this of these ships, they attract the creature. And then now they try to use it against it. So they just drop these sort of strobe flashlights to the tank of water to just lure it in the, and kill it with their CO2 cartridges and shotguns. And then it's just like, well, strobe lights food. And then Miguel Ferrer just like turns off his flashlight, just click, just
yeah.
Just, so, fine, I'm just, you know. Okay, small one, another one. Miguel Ferrer being told how to operate a shotgun.
So yes.
Everyone just like unpacks these just silver shotguns. They're just beautiful. And they just rack them, just.
Yeah.
And Miguel Ferrer
goes, you know how to use that, right?
And this lady, I think Norris, her name is, or maybe this is Nancy Everhart, just comes in, just flicks a switch like a safety, and just this is how you do it. And just this smile he just gives, like, it's just the best. Okay, another small one. Norris saying she's tired of this shit. I don't know if you remember the scene when there's only two women left. McBride is outside doing whatever he's doing. I think he's swimming somewhere. And then they're trapped with the creature in this room, and then Nancy Everhart's waiting for the room to decompress, so there's a timer going from 30 to 0, and then the creature just comes out and grabs Norris by the neck. And then and she has this like two electrodes, and she goes like, I'm tired of this shit, and just kills herself. And presumably the creature, but not really. It's just great. Okay, so now three big ones. The hatch killing the captain. Totally agree. Yes, that's the one. I've got three. The hatch killing the captain. And the whole idea of like this hatch being just made to look like it's very heavy, and the fact there is a comedic element on top of that, it's just like, I'm gonna rewire it and just get electrocuted for a second. which is a great scene. And then what happens later on, it's just like, I don't know why exactly, just the captain just floods the thing. I think he just wants to kill himself so they wouldn't have to choose.
Yeah.
But it's just a brilliant scene. Miguel Ferrer killing a guy slash also being told just like, well, they're out of date, these CO2 cartridges. Yes. And the woman just immediately tests it. I'm like, how much of an idiot can you be? Like, this is again, like you need like a local code of practice, like a little book. And then every 6 months on this ship, like you have to perform tests of these things. Or at least a safety inspection once every 4 weeks to at least make sure that everything's in date. I don't know. But then there's like, she inflates this sort of the pillow. And then he inflates a guy. Like, I knew someone's going to die, just like a balloon. But the best moment in the film, you mentioned this already, is when Miguel Ferrer dies. How he dies is just gruesome. It's just the best. Like, special effects-wise, it's just the best scene. I really love it. Especially that he's also... It's a massive dick move on his behalf. Bottoms?
Bottoms. Okay, so a couple small things here, and this might not be entirely fair because I'm sort of discussing gaffes here a little bit. But Jim, that's Matt McCoy, who really honestly drove me nuts here. I didn't like McCoy. He hops into the shower with Nia Peoples, and then in the very next scene that we see him, he's wearing the same clothes and he's dry. So... maybe not fair. However, I'll complain about that here. Here's one, another mini. The diving suit, why is it shaped with an arched back as if the person that's going to be getting in it has osteoporosis? I just thought it was sort of a weird look to this thing, because this suit is sort of bent over at the back. It's not someone standing erect. I thought it was just sort of a weird design.
Is it to allow them to get in there? How do they get in it?
Through the head. But I wondered that too. But still, why couldn't they just sort of just
slide in just at an angle? I don't know.
Maybe it had something to do with that. Anyway, to me, that looks like someone.
It looked cool.
The helmet looks cool. Just the bent back is sort of. Well, why is that? That's weird.
Yep. Ooh,
my, My power just flicked.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, the heavy door sequence. This is probably not fair. It's such a great scene. And actually, we talked, like, I talked so much about how much I love this set. But at one point, I think it's Avignon, that actor, mm-hmm. he comes back and Torian Black is underneath this really heavy door. But Avignon comes back and he puts his hand and, like, he puts his weight on the door and the door sort of bends in, showing that it's totally plastic. Anyway. So, yeah, I'm really nitpicking here, but these are the small ones. Okay. Yeah, so now for some real serious uglies. Again, Matt McCoy, some of his lines and just his smarmy behavior, he's reminding me of Murdoch from the A-Team. Just these.
He also has the cap.
Yes, true. He's just so in your face and smug. So he shoves, he borrows Nia Peoples' pen. Can I borrow your pen? And he sticks this pen in a garbage disposal to free up something that was stuck. And then he makes this smug comment when he returns the broken pen. Oh, I wouldn't put my own pen in the garbage disposal. And then, Dick. Yeah, like, just a total knob. And then at one point, he's pointing to his cheek, looking for a kiss from one of the other crew. Like, he's not a funny guy. It's just, he's over the top, and he's sort of driving me nuts in here. So McCoy and his sort of smugness. Another small little thing, as soon as McBride and Joyce get back after four crew members had died, so after their expedition to save people, it's McBride and Joyce return, and we've got four dead crew members. McCoy greets everyone with a big smile on his face, and everyone seems quite happy. There's a weird moment where just it's business as usual, and everyone seems happy, almost as if this was shot out of sequence and put in there. There's just sort of a weird, mm-hmm. weird moment in there. Number two, Scarpelli and Jim making out in the shower. You know, that's great.
Time you use the same scene.
I know, but this doesn't have to do with dry clothes after. Here, it's the thing is, and don't get me wrong, like, I sort of like Scarpelli in this, Nia Peoples, but, and this is great that these two characters are getting it on and have some sort of relationship, but it's never mentioned again. And, you know, like, good for them, but who cares? Why is this in here? What is the point of this? So that whole scene can go.
What if they don't have a relationship? Is she just has to pay somehow? It's like, oh, he just gave her his water. So it's like, I suppose I have to now do something, right?
So then that information should be paid off somewhere in the script.
The sexual politics of the ship is just gross.
Yeah, maybe she's doing that with all kinds of crew members for
maybe this is shower, just the currency.
Their extra
just,
shower they, credits,
like all these people do, and like they don't because they don't have any money. Money has no value for them in this ship. It's like all they trade in ass. So he's just thinking like Ferrago's like, oh, yeah. Can you cook me breakfast? And he's just like, well we gotta bang it out first.
Yeah. what you gonna do for me? Yeah, oh, you really want to get that shampoo out of your hair, do you? Well, I have some extra shower credit. But no matter what the story is here, develop it or leave it alone. And number one, and we were talking about this a bit, I feel there's problems here in communicating the size of the creature or the biology of the creature or the threat of the creature, because by the time it comes into the vessel, it seems to be a mini version of this gigantic terrorizing blip on the sonar. And it's just a bit of a letdown at that point. So that's it. There's the lack of payoff for the creature once we actually see it.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie. It's a lot of stuff. I only have three. I only have three. I just limited myself to three bottoms because I do like this film. So one thing, and I mentioned this already, and it's just more of a general thing, but it kind of just comes through in towards the ending when there's just like, oh, I'll marry anyone who just gets me out of the ship. And they still refer to each other in using their surnames. The whole idea of just, Scarpelli this, oh, McCoy that. And I'm like, don't you think like after like months together, they'll just be on first name basis? Ridiculous. Okay, and these two are just Miguel Ferrer's, because Miguel Ferrer's just—he's just the MVP of the show, like both top and bottom.
Agreed.
Miguel Ferrer casually blowing up a nuke after answering like a bunch of questions as well. Like, this whole scene's ridiculous. It's like, you know, I know it's just there to kind of pay off the iconography of Alien, because he has to, I mean, maybe I do have a soft spot for any time in any film when someone has to execute a self-destruct sequence of any kind and they have to press the buttons and then pull a lever, then just type in a sequence and whatever, and then just, I don't know, pull something out and something's going to just start winding up or whatever. It's great. That's why I like, you know, like Broken Arrow with their codes and whatever, and they're fighting over a remote. It's great. And then the worst is Miguel Ferrer's vision. This is sort of out of nowhere. This dream sequence when he sees the guy he blew up and just he says something to him and then just scares him into this sort of madness. Why? Why
are I you? Forgot that could be a remnant of Sean Cunningham dealing in slashers.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Maybe. It's probably quite likely it is. But it's just like out of nowhere, out of context with everything. Otherwise, this film is just always on the ground, like both feet firmly on the ground. And now we have a dream sequence for exactly 7 seconds.
The guy with the burst boob.
The guy with the burst boob just makes an appearance and scares Miguel Ferrer into getting the bends. And the bends to end all bends, by the way, because like he turns into just like he's just, oh. Like a character out of a Peter Jackson New Zealand horror film, you know.
Yes, it's 10 out of 10 nasty. It's great.
So it's awesome. Like the way Miguel Ferrer dies is just the best. Like second only to how he dies in RoboCop, I suppose. That's it. I think we did it. So Deep Star 6 is weirdly sort of available on a few streaming services in Canada and the US. In the UK or region 2, I think you have to make your own bed. In this regard, weirdly enough, I don't think it has much of a Blu-ray sort of presence. Maybe in region 1 it has some kind of a Shout Factory, I'm not sure. So you kind of have to improvise. I think your best bet is to find it on DVD. But yeah, that's it. We did it.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, Randy, can we find you? Social media and stuff.
You can find me on Twitter at Randy Burrows, and you can find me on Letterboxd at Bratch7, and you can find some of the stuff I write on clapperltd.co.uk.
Awesome. And you can find me, Talk About Film, Twitter, Jakub Flash, Letterboxd, flashonfilm.com, clapperltd.co.uk, and also follow the show at Uncut Gems Pod everywhere, which is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Also head over to our website, uncutgemspodcast.com, to check out all our previous recordings and everything else, because it's on one convenient location for you to browse and peruse with an A to Z index if you want to as well. And also remember to subscribe to our Patreon and support us with your hard-earned cash. And in exchange for your $3 a month sort of pledge, you will get access to everything we have stored in our Patreon, which is bonus podcasts, bonus tie-ins, remaining retrospectives, and our David Lynch marathon. And at this point, we kind of made a tacit promise, did we, to record an episode about The Abyss in addition to everything else we have planned for December. Yeah. Because December is a time of giving, you know?
That's right. So I was just making a note of that.
We're not giving ourselves a break. We're going to record an episode about The Abyss because it kind of makes sense. And we've already committed to doing the Gremlins and Ghostbusters sort of pairing as, because it makes sense too. So we kind of have to keep making sense, because we're not Jonathan Demme. We're not going to stop making sense.
It is better to give than receive. So here we go.
Anyway, so stay tuned for more bonus tie-ins this month. Not sure if there's going to be a retrospective coming into your ears in December, but there's going to be some bonus tie-ins and the big finale of our David Lynch marathon. And just a gentle reminder, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, the David Lynch episodes of our Twin Peaks sort of episodes of David Lynch marathon are available to listen to for free on our Patreon, patreon.com/uncutgemspod. Once again, $3 a month is what you need to pledge in order to get access to everything we have in there. But there's a few things in there for free, including the Twin Peaks episode. So that's us for today. Next week, we're going to be continuing our journey through Horrors of the Deep, the underwater scares, by talking about a different film from a different sort of run of films. And I think this is going to be the 1970, I can't remember now, I think it's 79.
I sort of forget the Nick Nolte film.
Yeah. And Robert Shaw.
Yep.
1977. We're going to be talking about the 1977 film directed by Peter Yates. And if you don't know who Peter Yates is, it's a guy who did Bullet, called The Deep. So stay tuned for that. And meanwhile, this is Deep Star. Have a good day.